Already, the cities of this region were engaged in the beginning of a caravan trade across the Tarim Basin to China. Furthermore, these satrapies, these upper satrapies, Transoxiana as we would call it, were home to very important Iranian nobles and barons who had to be brought under control. They were very powerful, and they represented a potential threat to Alexander and later his successors, the Seleucid kings of Syria, that is, the generals, the family of the general Seleucus who succeeded to Alexander's Asian empire. Alexander initially tried to set up a border. He established military cities, Alexandrias. Alexandria Escatate is one of the most famous. And he made the mistake of cutting off that contact between the Scythians, often known as Daha or Sakai. These were tribes of the Scythians, and the various caravan cities. And this just wasn't going to work. Alexander defeated them in a very, very famous tactical battle. But he came very quickly to realize that the whole way of dealing with nomads was not setting up a kind of Maginot line, but regulating the flow, the migration of tribes, the tempo of trade, and taxing it. And Alexander, by the time he withdrew from this region to invade India and eventually march home, he had established a number of Greek Macedonian colonies in Bactria on the Oxus River, which could be supported by agriculture. The reports are over 20,000 were settled. And for the next 125 years after his death, these cities evolved into Greek-style cities. We often call the region Greco-Bactrian or the Greco-Bactrian Kingdom. North of Bactria in Sogdiana along the Jaxartes, those areas were only loosely affiliated to the Greco-Bactrian Kingdom. Now, with Alexander's death in 323 BC, his empire was partitioned. Eventually, the Asian domains fell to the general Seleucus. He fell heir to Alexander's policy of dealing with Scythian nomads. However, that region, known as Bactria, which would today be parts of Afghanistan and Turkmenistan, that region broke away under its own rulers. A fellow by the name of Diodotus, somewhere around 250 BC, rebelled and set up his own independent Greek kingdom. This kingdom is actually known in Chinese sources, particularly our erstwhile envoy to the Xuan Nu, Xiang Tian, who actually reached the Greco-Bactrian kingdom somewhere around 128 or 127 BC after a long stay with his Xuan Nu wife, and he reported on the existence of this kingdom. He was very impressed by it. It's called Daxia in his account. But he also reports of two other important people. Foremost are people we met in the last lecture, the Yue Ji or Yue Ci, a peculiar Chinese rendition of a name that eventually gives rise to the famous Kushans. They probably really called themselves Tocharians, which is the name of the language on the Buddhist texts and essentially a version of the name used by the Greek sources. They seem to be the same people. And then the Sakai, who are also known to the Chinese. Both the Sakai, Iranian speakers, and the Kushans, the ancestors of the Kushans, let's call them Tocharians, were courted by the Chinese as allies. They were not particularly interested in getting involved, and both of them were in their locales, that is, north of Sogdiana, in the case of the Sakai, and in the case of the Kushans, just to the northeast of that region. They had been displaced here by the fighting between the Xuan Nu and the Chinese. And they took it upon themselves, somewhere around the middle of the 2nd century BC, to migrate into the settled zone of Transoxiana. We're not exactly sure why. They were probably driven by local conditions. The Sakai moved first, and they swept in 140 BC and did a pretty destructive job on the Greco-Bactrian kingdom. They pretty much smashed it. The Kushans came maybe 15 or 20 years later, and they moved into Bactria. The Sakai kept on moving into the Helmand Valley. They crossed the Bolan Pass and entered India. But the Tocharians, the ancestors of the Kushan emperors, they settled in the very prosperous area of Bactria. They took over the Greek cities and brought an end to Alexander's political legacy there, although the Hellenistic or the Greek-style civilization persisted. Now, the collapse of that frontier, of the Iranian world, that Hellenistic Iranian world, the world of the Persian Empire taken over by Alexander and his successors, was related, caused by the very movements that were a result of the Xuannu-Han Wars that had pushed these tribes, Tocharian speakers and Iranian speakers, westward from their eastern homes on the western and northwestern frontiers of the Chinese Empire. This is a pattern that will repeat itself. And these tribes have moved, they find new locales, and they eventually enter into Transoxiana in the Middle East. We will see this again with the migration of the Turks. The Scythians themselves, farther west, the bulk of the Scythians, they disappear somewhere in the 3rd century BC, and they give way to a new people known as the Sarmatians. These are the Iranian nomads whom the Romans will encounter, and the Sarmatian migration, which seems to have again originated from an east to west direction, are thought, or perhaps better surmised, to be yet another spin-off of that Xuannu-Han conflict that the ancestors of the Sarmatians had started out in the regions around the Aral Sea. They were on the central steppes. They migrated westward. They crossed the Ural. And sometime shortly after 300 BC, they took over the Scythian Confederation and dominated now those western Eurasian steppes, essentially from the lower Danube to the Volga. The result is that the patterns we see evolving with the Scythians are patterns that are going to repeat themselves at later periods. And the Scythians, in many ways, are the rulers who wrote the script of how to dominate those western Eurasian steppes. It's done by trade. It's done by coming into accommodation with the civilized states. But there is always the danger that the system can be unhinged by newcomers who've been pressed east because of the wars between Chinese emperors and other nomadic peoples out on the eastern steppes.
Lecture 6. The Parthians.
In this lecture and the next lecture, we're going to deal with three new steppe nomadic peoples, the Parthians, the Sakai, and Tocharian speakers who eventually came to be known as the Kushans. I think it would be useful, before we plunge into this lecture, which will be dealing particularly with the Parthians, that we look for a moment of where we've been and where we are going. The Parthians are a Iranian-speaking nomadic peoples. They, in effect, are an offshoot of the Scythians of whom we've spoken. The Sakai are also Iranian speakers. The Kushans, or the ancestors of the Kushans, are Tocharian speakers. All three of these people in the 3rd and 2nd century BC came to play an extremely important role in both northern India and the Middle East. And it is useful to remember that their activities are more or less contemporary with the Xuannu. And in fact, at least two of these people, the Sakai and the Kushans, were set in motion by fighting with the Xuannu as well as the struggle between the Xuannu and the Han emperors. So that gives you some kind of chronological context. We are now dealing with that central steppe area approximately at the same time that the Chinese have their first serious dealings with nomadic peoples. And we will see certain similarities in the relationships between the nomadic peoples of the central steppes and the civilized societies that we saw with China and the Xuannu. Well, with that in mind, let us turn to the Parthians. The Parthians, between 247 and 129 BC, carved out a large empire stretching from what is today Iraq into parts of Afghanistan and Turkmenistan. They essentially gained control of the Iranian heartland. And they wrested control of this region from the Seleucid kings. The Seleucid kings, as you may recall, were the Macedonian generals, a family of Macedonian generals, who had fought with Alexander the Great. The founder was King Seleucus, who in 312 BC took the title king, king of Babylon. And he and his successors ruled over the Asian sections of the Empire of Alexander, which had stretched from the Aegean to the Indus, and that empire had tended to fragment steadily over time. And what had happened to the Seleucid state is that by the middle of the 3rd century BC, in 247 BC, when we get our first record of the Arsacid rulers, that is, the Arsacid kings of Parthia, that the satraps, and the satraps refer to the governors, the satraps or governors in the Seleucid Empire had more or less asserted their independence. And it was increasingly difficult for Seleucid kings in Babylon and the great capital of Antioch to keep control over these distant provinces. In one area, along the northern frontier, the traditional frontier that divides the nomadic peoples from the Iranian heartland, and that would be an eastern extension of the Elburz Mountains that extends beyond the Caspian, this region that is later known as Khorasan in Islamic times, there was a tribe of Iranian speakers known as the Parni who migrated into the northern districts of Iran. And they exploited the Seleucid weakness to essentially create their own principality. There are two brothers, according to the Greek sources, a fellow named Arsaces and his younger brother Tiridates. And it is from Arsaces, the elder of the two, that we take the name Arsacid, which means descendants of Arsaces. It's a typical way of referring to dynasties. They carved out a principality. They came to terms with the Seleucid king and essentially were recognized as rulers who functioned as satraps or governors. And the son of the first Arsaces, Arsaces II, who ruled after his father between 211 and 191 BC, he actually began to synthesize the various elements, unite the various groups in that region, and took the name Parthian. Parthia originally referred to a district. At the time, Alexander the Great had moved through there, about 125 years earlier, it had been a geographic designation. But this king, Arsaces II, turns it into an ethnic designation. It comes to mean the various Parthian retainers of the Arsacid king who give their loyalty to the king and remain fundamentally nomads in their political organization, in their way of war, and a good deal of their customs. And what the Parthian kings do is conquer an Iranian empire and attempt to rule it from horseback. And in this regard, they will act in a way as prototypes for the later Turkish dynasts, known as sultans and emirs, who will do very much the same in the medieval period, that is, conquer the great cities of the Islamic world and attempt to rule them based on nomadic military power and coming to some kind of accommodation with the existing institutions. Arsaces II was a very astute and adroit king. He submitted to the Seleucid king Antiochus III. Antiochus III, who took the name Great, he appropriated it for himself, and no one knew better than Antiochus. He saw himself as the embodiment of Alexander the Great. He conducted a great anabasis, an eastern march, to bring all the eastern satrapies under control. Of course, the Parthians submitted. Arsaces recognized himself as a vassal of the great Seleucid king. Antiochus marched off to India, got war elephants, and eventually made his way back to the Mediterranean world. Unfortunately, Antiochus's activities came to the attention of Rome, and in 190 BC, the Romans destroyed his army at the Battle of Magnesia in one of the great victories that demonstrated the superiority of the legion over the Macedonian phalanx, and Seleucid power began to fragment very rapidly thereafter. Well, that gave an opportunity for the Parthian rulers to assert their independence. And starting from 190 BC, down to essentially 63 BC, successive Parthian kings gathered up the eastern heritage of the Seleucid kings. The turning point comes in the reign of a king known as Mithridates I. And the name Mithridates is significant. The name is taken after the Indo-Iranian god Mitra, or Mithras, who becomes a popular god in the Roman Empire. He's known in the Rig Vedas. He's known among the earliest of the Iranian gods. And it is suggestive that the Parthians had always retained that ancient polytheistic Iranian faith rites. They were not Zoroastrian monotheists. We'll get into that later on in the talk. And Mithridates I has several important achievements to his name. In 140 BC, he decisively defeated and captured King Demetrius II, the Seleucid king, put Demetrius under house arrest. Demetrius then went on to a very colorful career. He tried to escape several times. He was married to a princess of the Parthian royal family. He was an absolutely irrepressible figure and eventually is released in 129 BC by the Parthian king in order to plague his family back in Syria and in Mesopotamia. But that victory in 140 BC assured that the Parthian kings would gain control of Iran, particularly the ancient lands of Media and Persia. And increasingly, the Parthian kings came to assume many of the roles of the great king of Persia and had to come to terms with that bureaucratic ancient monarchy of the Achaemenid kings. Mithridates also defeated the Greco-Bactrian rulers. These were the Greek kings ruling in Bactria. That would today be northern Afghanistan. Their capital was the city Bactra, today Balkh on the upper Oxus River, studded with important caravan cities. And the Bactrian kings also exercised control over Ferghana, that is ancient Sogdiana, and were involved in the trade across the Tarim Basin to China. So certain districts were wrested from the control of these kings, notably Margiane, which is the modern city of Merv, and Arya, Herat, two critical caravan cities on the emerging Silk Road. The Seleucids tried to make a comeback. In 129 BC, it is decisively defeated by the Parthian king Phratres II, who defeats that Seleucid comeback under Antiochus VII. He actually kills the Seleucid king. And at that point, the Seleucids are pretty much out of it. And the Parthian kings come to rule the eastern half of the former Seleucid Empire. It is a stunning achievement by nomads. And in part, this is because on the terrain of Iran and Central Asia, the classic nomadic cavalry tactics are very, very much useful against Macedonian-style armies, depending heavily on the traditional infantry phalanx and heavy cavalry. And in all instances, the Parthians usually wear down their opponent by skirmishing and strategic withdrawal, and then in the decisive battle, they usually are able to encircle and defeat an already exhausted Seleucid army. And this accounts for their successive victories fighting against the Seleucid kings. Well, the reign of Mithridates I also marks another important turning point, and that is from now on, these Parthian kings are ruling not just the crucial nomadic peoples along the northern frontier of the Iranian world, but they're now ruling the heartland of Iran itself, as well as the wealthy cities of Babylonia, that is today lower Iraq. That includes the city of Babylon. It also includes an important new city that was established by the Parthian kings, and that is Ctesiphon. On the upper Tigris, it's in the vicinity of Baghdad today, and it becomes essentially the Parthian capital where the court resides. There also is nearby a Seleucid city, Seleukia ad Tigrum, which is essentially on the east bank and slightly south of Ctesiphon on the Tigris. And those two twin cities become essentially the court and capital of this Parthian empire and fuel a great deal of the economic development. At the same time, the Parthian kings begin to change the way they project themselves. One of our best pieces of evidence are Parthian coins. Now, it's often been remarked that we would know very little about the Parthians had it not been for the survival of large numbers of silver coins. These silver coins have come down to us in great numbers, and by studying the coins, it documents how the Parthians, a nomadic invader, came to terms with the traditions of a bureaucratic state. It is significant, for instance, that the Chinese envoy, our friend Zhuang Jian, the erstwhile envoy to the Xuan Nu, when he finally made it west, somewhere around 128, 127 BC, he actually discovered a kingdom he calls Anxia or Anxia, which apparently is a Chinese rendering of Arsacid, that is using the dynastic name to designate the Parthian kingdom. And he remarks, for a man who comes from a world in which only copper coins are used, he remarks how impressive Parthian silver coins are because they carry the portraits of kings. And Chinese coins only carry calligraphy designating the date and the emperor when the coin was put out. Those are cast bronze coins. The coins, therefore, act as a very important record and guide to Parthian political and cultural pretensions. Starting with Mithridates I, royal portraits are modeled increasingly first after Seleucid kings. The Parthian king discards the traditional nomadic felt cap and begins to wear the diadem, that is the pearl headdress used in ancient Persian royalty and was adopted by Alexander the Great and many of the Hellenistic monarchs. And by the way, those pearls come from the Red Sea, and it's an important royal monopoly that emerges in the Parthian and the later Sassanid periods. The reverse of the coins shows an archer dressed in traditional nomadic dress with felt cap, the usual leather breeches, and of course, that ubiquitous recurved bow, that is the half figure eight bow. He's usually seated in a position to remind the viewer that this is the source of royal power. That type remains the same throughout Parthian coinage on these silver coins, which are known as drachmae. It is also significant that the coins carry their inscriptions, or as numismatists like to call them, legends, in Greek. Now, that might be curious for a moment. Why Greek? They're ruling an Iranian state. Aramaic is a commercial language. As far as we can tell, the Parthians spoke an East Iranian dialect. And the reason they use Greek, it's because it's recognized as an administrative and commercial language across much of the Near East. Several languages in the history of the Near East have played this role. The first was Akkadian, written in cuneiform. The second was Aramaic, and the third is Greek, written in an alphabetic system. For all international correspondence between kings or merchant princes or even kings to their governors, the written language used was known by the scribe. And the Parthian king would speak in his native language, his native Iranian language. The scribe would, however, write the letter in Greek. The letter would then be sent to the other end. And the scribe at that end, who also knew Greek, would then translate the Greek into the appropriate language. It could be Iranian, it could be Tocharian, or in some cases, if he's corresponding to the Roman emperor, it would be Latin. And so Greek and Aramaic played that function across the Near East. They were privileged written languages, and most nomadic conquerors very quickly came to terms with this fact and employed these languages rather than their native language in communication. The Sakai and the Kushans did very much the same, as we'll see in the upcoming lecture. So the adoption of Greek is in effect saying, we are serious monarchs. The king Mithridates II, who had a very, very long reign, a very important reign, he ruled in the second, early first century BC, died somewhere in 88 or 87 BC. He begins to sport the full regalia of the great king of Persia. And his coins project an imperial rank that we are now not just nomadic conquerors, but also the heirs to the Achaemenid Empire. And this tradition persists on Parthian coinage, really, down to the end of the dynasty, usually dated in 227 AD, when they are defeated and overthrown by a native Persian dynasty, the so-called Sassanids, who will then restore the traditional Persian bureaucratic state and essentially get rid of these Parthian interlopers who are a bunch of nomads off the steppes, whom the Persians never particularly cared for. In any way, to the Persians, they're not even good Zoroastrians. So there are a lot of things wrong with the Parthian rulers to the traditional Persians. In addition, besides taking on these royal pretensions from the Achaemenid period, the Parthians proved themselves adaptable conquerors, and in some ways employed some of the techniques that we saw with Modu Chanyu in putting together his confederation of the Shuang Nu. The great king of the Parthians, the Arsacid king of the Parthians, came to terms with numerous rulers within his empire. At the city of Kararex on the Persian Gulf, with the kings of Persia, Fars province today, who eventually would overthrow them. with rulers in Mesopotamia, and also with rulers on the eastern frontiers. There, the Parthian king invested these sub-kings with titles and essentially ruled them as an extension of the old notion of a tribal confederation. In particular, in the eastern areas, where the Parthian kings faced serious threats from the Sakai and the Kushan emperors, and we'll talk about them in the next lecture, there, in regions that historically were known in the classical age as Drangiana, which is today essentially Sestan, and Arakosha, which is now Baluchistan, part of Pakistan, in that important border area, the Parthian kings entrusted control to one of the leading families, and this was the Surin family. This was a hereditary group of commanders who essentially ruled as a combination of local prince and satrap, as well as marshal, commander of the Arsacid armies. We know of none of the names of these men. They're only called the Suran, but they held this hereditary position through the Parthian age. It would be one of these men, a Suran, who will defeat the Roman army at Carrhae in 53 BC. And some scholars believe that the Suran gave rise to one of the famous heroes of medieval Persian literature, and that is the hero Rustam, who is well known in Persian miniatures and combat scenes and is a figure who is known in Persian epic. It is believed that this figure, the Suran, gave rise to that epic figure well known in the Shahnameh, the Epic of the Kings in medieval Persia. And it also points to the loose structure of the Parthian state. Another feature of that loose structure was the Parthians were always children of the steppes. And one could argue that they ruled their Iranian empire from horseback to a large extent. That meant they also practiced lateral succession. I mentioned that fact with the Shuang Nu in the lectures on their relationships with the Chinese Empire, and that is there was not a strict hereditary succession from father to son. Far from it. There was some kind of rough and ready approval by the leading families, and there are apparently seven of them, including the Suran family, that come to some kind of consensus, an agreement without voting, that when a Arsacid king dies, who is the next senior relative, male relative, in best position to take over? It could be a brother. It could be a cousin. Sometimes it's an uncle. And that always risks the danger of civil war, particularly if there are several possible candidates. This is what plagued the Confederacy of the Shuang Nu, which the later Han emperors exploited. It is a weakness that you see in the Parthian state. In a moment, we'll talk about how the Roman emperors also exploited it. And again, it is a weakness that we will see even in the Mongol Empire, especially after the death of Genghis Khan in 127 AD. The Mongol Empire is rocked by a series of succession crises arising from that lateral succession principle. Even so, it is astonishing at how successfully the Parthians ruled their empire. Part of it was their general policy of toleration of various cults and divinities. The coins depict various gods from the Greek pantheon. Those were the coins issued in the great cities, notably Seleucia ad Tigrum, that issued particularly large silver coins known as tetradrachmai. Reliefs show that the Greek god Heracles, the ancient Persian divinities such as Mithra were all approved of. There was no effort to favor one religious tradition over another. And again, that is a very traditional pragmatic policy of the steppes. We will see that with the Kushan.